Businesses have a responsibility throughout their entire value chains to respect human rights. If you can apply pressure at the top of the supply chain strategically, then you can achieve change at the bottom.
You are listening to Radio Atticus,
your national program on the law in the name of social justice.
This is obviously a live issue, and we need to start to talk about how we might regulate it here that we aren't outsourcing our problems.
People are curious. They look at you and they want to know your story.
Radio Atticus, more than the vibe.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Radio Atticus, your national program on the law in the name of social justice. And this is your host, Anna Marie Reyes. In this program, we look into the film titled Defiant Lives chronicles the experience of activists in defending the rights of people with disability in Australia, the UK and New Zealand. But first, active action by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people of Australia against police abuse through a project called Cupwatch, recording these actions using smartphones. Reporter Sophia Carvajal has more.
With footage of Aboriginal people dying in police custody and the torture of Aboriginal kids at Don Dale in the Northern Territory, a new initiative is being developed to watch the watchdogs. Cupwatch is a citizen journalist training program teaching Indigenous communities in New South Wales how to record human rights abuse by police via their mobile phones. The project is currently running as a trial and raising money via crowdfunding. I talked to George Newhouse, Principal Solicitor of the National Justice Project, a human rights and social justice legal service, about the new initiative.
Many people don't realise that there are severe community relations problems with police that need addressing, and as yet we're not aware of any other program like it. The motivation for this program came from residents of Kalgoorlie, Aboriginal residents of Kalgoorlie, who contacted us soon after the riots there, after the death of Elijah Doherty, and said, can you please help us? Our kids are being over-policed, they're being discriminated against, they're suffering prejudice. Could you help us? And that, in many ways, inspired this response through the Cupwatch program. The concept behind Cupwatch is quite simple. It's about two things: training Aboriginal communities about their rights to film police and authority figures in public, and also teaching them how to use that information in social media and become citizen journalists to advocate for change. Often Aboriginal people are faced with a situation in the criminal justice system where it's their word against multiple police officers. And the only way that they can contradict them is by having visual evidence. We think that this is a very powerful tool in the hands of Indigenous Australians who are innocent of the crimes that they're alleged to have committed, and where they can prove with visual evidence that it wasn't them, they didn't do the things that they are alleged to have done, and it's not simply a case of their word against others.
Here, the conversation turns to Justine Damond, the Australian woman fatally shot in the States by a policeman who was wearing a body cam but did not have it on at the time.
Police and their body cams. The police are not using them appropriately, and that's what you've seen highlighted in Missouri in that tragic death. We don't know what happened to that poor woman because the police officers chose to turn off the videos. The video camera.
I believe that they didn't turn it on before.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, whether they chose to turn them off or refused to turn them on, they were not on at the time. And that happens a lot in New South Wales, where police have the choice as to when they turn on their cameras and when they turn them off. So, of course, they turn them on when it suits them, when the behaviour of people is such that it's worth filming. They don't have it on when it's their own behaviour that's under scrutiny. And it's vital that if police are going to wear body cameras, that they be on all the time. And if they're not, it's essential that the community holds them accountable through our Cupwatch program by filming them. Everyone benefits. from having accountability and scrutiny, and that's why this program is being taken up by Aboriginal communities.
You're listening to Solicitor George Newhouse talking about Copwatch, a citizen journalist initiative to watch the watchdogs.
What would you say to critics who would say it heightens tensions and mistrust between officers and community members?
Well, as the police say themselves, officers have nothing to be afraid of if they're behaving appropriately. So any officer that is intimidated at all by a camera has something to hide. If they're doing their job properly, good luck to them. Police have a very important role in our society, but they have to do it in accordance with the law. If they're expecting Aboriginal communities to comply with the law, why shouldn't they?
So what kind of people are teaching them these things?
We have Indigenous presenters, and we are also looking at people with experience in cameras and even drones to assist with the training. They are both Indigenous and non-Indigenous people.
This program aims to educate and train people to become citizen journalists. Is there a danger in being in that situation, recording these events and making themselves vulnerable? And what does the program teach them to do in those situations?
Look, there are very real, practical, moral and ethical and legal issues involved in filming in public. Now, we try and address these issues through our training sessions. We deal with the moral issues, we deal with the practical issues of filming a scene where a crime might be taking place, for example. If someone punches a police officer, then not only do you have evidence of what the police officer's actions were in that situation, you actually have evidence about what community members have done. And that could be used against a fellow community member. So it's absolutely vital that people understand when they're filming that they are filming everyone and that everyone has to behave themselves. They can't expect the police to behave appropriately and not their own community members. We also teach individuals about streaming or storing to a cloud storage unit rather than having information stored on a phone, because that can be deleted by the police. Even things like using a thumbprint should be avoided to unlock your phone, because police can hold a phone to your thumb and open it that way. So it's absolutely vital that you use a code rather than a thumbprint. So there are many practical issues that we address and deal with. But people should be aware that when they're filming in public, everyone's actions are going to be accountable.
This program is specifically targeted to the Indigenous community. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes, it's absolutely targeted to Indigenous communities, because they are the ones who are at the forefront of dysfunctional police-community relations. Now, of course, the project may have application in other communities, but we are trialling it amongst Aboriginal communities first. We are only going to those communities who invite us and feel that they have a need for this kind of education and training. So obviously any communities that have a good relationship with police, and there's many of them, they won't need Copwatch or invite us to come and talk to them. But there are plenty of communities around Australia who have contacted us and suggested that we should get out there as quick as possible to help them.
Moving more widely now, is Copwatch influenced by the Black Lives Matter in the state, which, for listeners who don't know, I'm just going to quickly explain it, is the quote from their website: "The Black Lives Matter is an ideological and political intervention in a world where black lives are systematically and intentionally targeted."
Well, we aren't ideological. So in that respect, we are not like Black Lives Matter. But what we are doing is taking one of their tools and empowering Aboriginal communities. We are giving Aboriginal communities a voice. We are giving them a way of showing and highlighting to the world any injustices that they are suffering. And if they're not suffering injustices, they won't be able to film any. I mean, all we're doing is empowering vulnerable people. Black Lives Matter is a much bigger movement. It actually has an ideology. We don't have that ideology, apart from promoting social justice. In that respect, I suppose, we're similar. But this tool is something that the Black Lives Matter movement has got behind, and we see it being relevant in Australia as well. We don't rely on government funding, and that enables us to speak out and speak out loudly about social justice issues. When we say it's been a long time coming, I think Australian history is littered with cases of authority figures abusing Aboriginal communities. I mean, it dates back to colonial times and the first invasion of Australia. And so it's been hundreds of years in coming.
Tell us about the fundraising on chuff.org. How much have you raised so far?
Well, last time I looked, there was slightly over $40,000. That money is going to be used to transport and pay trainers to travel to some communities which are remote around Australia and give these training sessions. So we're hoping to raise $20,000 more so that we can go and visit a number of other communities. We've had invitations from 16 new communities to come and visit them. So all I can say is that there's definitely a need. And my hope is that there will come a day when we aren't necessary, when people don't need to tell stories of injustice because they are not being over-policed or harassed or the police are not behaving inappropriately. I'm hoping that the day will come when community relations with police are such that our role is completely unnecessary.
What's at stake if Copwatch is not funded?
Well, look, communities are going to miss out. We have enough to cover a trial. It is necessary. We are paying our Indigenous trainers to come out to communities. It is necessary to train those communities. So they'll miss out if we don't raise that money.
We were talking about Copwatch with George Newhouse, Principal Solicitor of the National Justice Project.
That report by Sophia Carvajal ending that interview with Principal Solicitor George Newhouse. You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER. I'm Anna-Marie Reyes.
2SER. 107.3 FM.
Well, I'm Gillian Triggs, and for legal news, facts and opinion, listen to Radio Atticus.
This August, Think Inc. are proud to bring writer, broadcaster and scientific historian Kenan Malik to Sydney for one night only at the Seymour Centre for Kenan Malik Post-Truth Era. Kenan Malik will discuss the failure of multiculturalism, the rise of post-truth and how politicians feed off our fear of the other. On August 8, Think Inc. and Kenan Malik will challenge your concepts of truth and race. Book your tickets today at thinkinc.org.au. Think Inc., sponsors of 2SER.
So what's happening this week?
Have you ever seen laser beams in the sky?
What were you thinking?
I find an opportunity to lick Richard Wilkins.
Okay. Interviews and discussions and all sorts of interesting things. 107.3.
2SER.
Defiant Lives is a new documentary film charting the rise of the disability rights movement in Australia, the UK and the USA. The film looks at how activists around the world help free their people from incarceration within institutional settings and have come to a new understanding of disability as a problem of society rather than as a problem existing within individuals. Reporter Vanessa Powell spoke to film director Sarah Barton.
Your work over many years has focused on advocating for the rights of people with disabilities through film and television. I'm just wondering how you became interested in this area. What sparked your passion?
Oh, look, so I actually started making films about disability back in the 1990s. My first film in 1994 was a film called Untold Desires, which was about sex and disability. And, look, that came out of some early experiences I had where my first husband was involved in a serious car accident and had a severe acquired brain injury. But then later on, my daughter... also developed cerebral palsy after a difficult birth, and so that sort of kept me interested, it kept me going. So, you know, I've had a few people close to me over my lifetime that have made me really look and think closely about disability and disability rights, and so they're the kind of the people that have really spurred me on, but I guess, you know, I'm pretty interested in it once I started sort of working in the field.
Your first film, Untold Desires, that was really groundbreaking.
I think so. Yeah. Look, I think at a time, you know, it was back in 1994 and it looked at sexuality and disability, and I don't think anyone had really done that. And I don't know that anyone's really done it since. You know, a lot of people remember the film Scarlet Road, which was about a sex worker who worked with people with disabilities, and that's not my film. My film was sort of like a lot earlier than that and was really much more about people with disability and their sexuality in all its kind of breadth, and really looking beyond the sort of the obvious thing, which is, you know, the role that sex workers can play, but really looking beyond that into relationships and that sort of thing. So I think when people see that film, even though it's like more than 20 years old now, it still resonates for people, and I still get, you know, very positive feedback about the quality of that film, which is lovely, really.
In your new film, Defiant Lives, I think you touch on the topic of sexuality again, because you interview, I think it was a woman in an institutional setting maybe, but she fell madly in love with a man. And then she goes on to say she was dumped by her boyfriend and had her baby taken away from her.
Yeah, look, that story is really way less about sexuality and really more about the sort of abuse, the routine abuse that people in institutions suffered and the kind of hardship and heartache that they suffered. So certainly if you're looking, you know, as a reference between, you know, my earlier film, Untold Desires, which was very much about a positive kind of portrayal and a positive look at sexuality and disability, the sort of anecdote that Jean Searle tells in Defiant Lives is really, you know, not that kind of a story at all, and is more really, you know, about the kind of the hardships and abuse. So I really didn't go into sexuality a lot at all in a sort of positive way in Defiant Lives, because I felt like I'd done it so much in Untold Desires. So it really, Defiant Lives is really a much more political film, I guess. You know, about the sort of rights movement and the activists who actually sort of took to the streets and literally changed the world we live in.
So how much did you know about the disability rights movement before you started this film?
Look, I didn't know very much. I'd heard a couple of stories. I had a sort of feeling that, you know, that maybe, you know, there were some actions sort of created by Vietnam veterans, and that actually wasn't what I found when I started looking a little bit deeper into it. So really, I started pretty much from scratch. I sort of knew that there had been a disability rights movement. I knew that there'd been disabled activists in Melbourne who'd taken to the streets over various issues. But when I started to look overseas in the US and the UK, you know, I found what was actually a very well organised and well connected rights movement of people who were, you know, sort of really talking to each other about the issues and working quite systematically to try and dismantle the barriers that disabled people face, particularly in the urban built environment, but also in places like education and really all across society.
The thing I found interesting was the story of Jerry Lewis and his involvement with the telethon for muscular dystrophy. Did you know about this story beforehand?
Well, yeah, that was actually one of the few stories I did know about, because when I was making No Limits, the community television series that I made in the early sort of 2000s with Stella Young and other disabled performers, it was around the time there was a film made in America called it was a little short film that we sort of profiled in No Limits, and it was called the Jerry Lewis Yellathon. And it was a send-up of the Jerry Lewis telethon. And so through that little short film, I became aware that not only had we had the Urella telethon here in Melbourne and you know, other sort of charity telethons that were around Australia, but in fact, you know, Jerry Lewis was kind of the king of the telethon in this kind of really schmaltzy, schmoozy sort of television sort of pity fest, really, which was him sort of, you know, dragging out a whole lot of, you know, sort of poor disabled children and sort of weeping all over them in order to get the general public to hand over large amounts of money for medical research. So I was kind of aware of the Jerry Lewis telethon. That was one of the things that I did know about before I started my research, because I'd been exposed to it. And we had a reference point for something in Australia which wasn't nearly as bad, but was along the same lines.
Yeah, that was the Miss Australia quest, right?
Well, yeah, the Miss Australia quest was one, but before the Miss Australia quest, we had these TV telethons, a little bit like, I don't know what you have in New South Wales as an equivalent, but in Melbourne we have the Royal Children's Hospital Appeal, which happens on Good Friday and has been going for donkey's years. But before that, or maybe in parallel with that, there was a thing called the Yarralla Telethon, and Yarralla's a big disability service provider here in Melbourne. And I think the idea was replicated in cities, you know, states all around Australia, where there would be this telethon of, you know, singers and dancers and you know, little disabled children dragged out onto television in order to raise money for a big service provider. So that sort of model was definitely up and running here. The Yarralla Telethon, I should add, you know, ended in the 1970s. It was banished, you know, a long time ago. The Miss Australia quest persisted right through till 2000, and there were a lot of protests about that because they really never listened to the voices of disabled people with that.
Yeah, so I think the point was that these telethons raise money for medical research, and that very little of this money goes back to people that actually live their lives with disabilities, right?
Well, certainly that was the point that was made by the Americans talking about Jerry Lewis, you know, that the lion's share of that money went to medical research, and the whole objective was a very medical one, in that it was to cure this disease, you know. So they never really looked at the sort of rights of people living with the disease and you know, how people might live better lives, you know, but through better social support. You know, it was just a 100% focus on medical research and how can we sort of banish this disease. And I think disabled people, you know, really got up and said, no, this is not what we... you know, what we want to do. This is not how we want to be seen. So, you know, I think, and when that's the only portrayal of disability on television, then all people learn, you know, as an audience, is to pity disabled people. And so that doesn't help at all. It's very unhelpful.
So Defiant Lives, I think you film across three countries, right? Australia, the US and the UK.
Yes.
Were you able to make any kind of generalisations about the differences in each country's context?
Well, yes, I did sort of... I was at one point able to sort of make some general observations, and really the way disabled people and disability rights have been sort of played out in the different countries is really a reflection of the sort of broader socioeconomic way of running things. So in the UK, you know, although now that, you know, they're really battling sort of the austerity measures that are kind of prevailing at the moment, but you know, for many decades the UK has had a very strong and proud tradition of, you know, of the welfare state and providing things like the national health and pensions and other kind of forms of social security. And to a lesser extent, but certainly greater than in the US, we also did things like that in Australia, although ours has been dismantled, you know, for quite a long time now. I think, you know, our peak was probably in the 1980s, when, you know, Social Security really did provide a good safety net for Australians. But in America, it's very individualistic, and, you know, they don't believe in socialism at all, and it's a very dirty word, and they really have very little in the way of safety net, but also their medical system, which, of course, you know, shapes disabled people's lives a great deal in America because, well, everywhere, you know, people with disability are probably more closely engaged with the medical system. So where you've got a good, strong medical system, people with disabilities do better. When the medical system is expensive and unavailable to people, it creates enormous hardship in their lives. So there were some generalisations that I could make, and you know, I think the film sort of, you know, does reference that context.
So in America, I think they have a much stronger conception of rights and freedoms. Does that assist people with disabilities?
So they have, you know, this constitutional, you know, right to individual freedom. And that's not really something that is so important in the UK and here. You know, we seem to be better at doing interconnectedness and community. Whereas, you know, in America, they really do focus on those individual rights.
So why do you think it is that people with disabilities are treated so badly here, considering that we will all have a disability at one stage in our lives?
I think that society, you know, people don't really know how to, you know, what to do. I think a lot of it comes from ignorance and some of it comes from fear. I think disability, you know, can be a bit like death. It's something we want to avert our eyes from and not think about. And I think, you know, what I'm trying to do with my work is to say, okay, it's not the end of the world. It's not a fate worse than death. It's okay to engage with disability with disabled people and to, you know, that people need to be treated the same as everyone else. So I think a lot of it is ignorance and fear, not so much that people have any kind of, you know, bad attitude, you know. But of course also, you know, people need to understand that, you know, it's part of that sort of social safety net, and, you know, disabled people do depend on having some community support.
So once again, I think you're breaking new ground in this film, because you really reframe disability as something that's not an individual problem, but that's something that's a problem for all of society. Is that right?
Yes. I think, you know, disability is something we all need to look at. I mean, it is, you know, the largest minority that anyone can become a member of at any time by virtue of, you know, sort of illness or accident. And I think it is a concern for everybody. You know, I think in Australia, when the National Disability Insurance Scheme was framed, it was framed as a scheme for everybody because it provides a social safety net for anyone who becomes disabled. You know, it doesn't, it's there for everybody, and that's how we should see it. And I think, you know, that the mark of a civilised society is, you know, how we look after our, you know, our more vulnerable citizens. And so I think, you know, it's absolutely something that we all should be very, very concerned and engaged with.
Well, I saw the film. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was fantastic. How do people watch the film?
We're releasing the film in cinemas through Demand Film. And I'll just explain the Demand Film model very quickly. It's basically it's a sort of crowdsourcing cinema screening. So it allows a film like Defiant Lives to have a cinema release where it might not otherwise. And it's wonderful in the cinema because the soundtrack, the sort of atmosphere of the film is really, really very powerful in the cinema. So I urge people to see it in the cinema. But the way you do it is you need to book your tickets in advance. So people can go to demand.film and look for Defiant Lives. We have a few screenings up in Sydney and in New South Wales at the moment. So it's not on every day. You need to find the screening near you that you can go to and pre-book your tickets. And basically, if we feel we've got enough bookings 7 days out from the screening, then we confirm the screening going ahead, and we can still sell more tickets, obviously, beyond that 7-day period.
Sarah Barton there, filmmaker of Defiant Lives and Ending That Report.
I'm Michael Kirby, and you are listening to Radio Atticus. Radio Atticus is part of the Community Radio Network. I was formerly a Justice of the High Court of Australia with no time to listen to this, but now I sit glued to Radio Atticus.
What have you always wondered about Sydney and the people who call it home? 2SER is Seeking Sydney. Head over to 2ser.com and ask the questions you want our team to investigate. While you're there, why not vote for whichever question you'd like answered? 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music.
2SER 107.3, and this week we're probing the dark recesses of the mind.
Oogum boogum.
Very scary.
Did you wet yourself?
It could happen to you.
Stick around even if that scene does disturb you too much.
A shout out to all our listeners around the country, to Bob FM in Taree, New South Wales, to MIA Griffith, New South Wales, to RRR Gladesville, New South Wales, to Wet Tank FM in West Kempsey, New South Wales, to XXFM, Canberra ACT, 3CR Victoria, 3UHFM in Alexandra, Victoria, 4NSA Noosa Heads, Queensland, 7RPH Hobart, Tasmania, 8CCC Alice Springs ACT, 3CH Wooden, Victoria, and more. Your ongoing support is keeping us going. Thank you.
2SER, live and streaming at 2SER.com.
And that's about all we have time for in this edition. I hope you enjoyed the show. Feel free to find us on the 2SER website on our past podcasts by going to the program guide and select Radio Atticus. Tune in again next week for more Law in the Name of Social Justice here on Radio Atticus. I'm Anne-Marie Reyes saying,